listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past few years, the catch of fish worldwide has plateaued at 90 million tons a year, but demand continues to increase, and diners, shoppers, and cooks have turned to farm-raised fish to make up the difference. It's estimated that farm fish now accounts for half of the fish eaten around the world. But like any kind of farming, there are concerns about the environmental and health impacts of this this production on such a big scale. And joining me now is Brian Walsh, a senior writer for Time magazine, whose article, The End of the Line, appears in the July 18th issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased that it has brought him back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
We've manipulated wild foods and turned them into crops. We've domesticated cattle and other animals for millennia. So does the decision to farm fish appear to be all that different?
Well, I think it's different in the sense that fish have been that last wild food, that last connection that goes back to a time when we did just hunt and gather, really. I mean, we've been raising food, raising animals on land for thousands and thousands of years. This is something that has a long history. But it's only recently, really, over the last several decades, that you've seen aquaculture, which is another name for fish farming, on a sort of mass scale.
Well, there was fish farming back 4,000 years ago in China. But that was just the exception to the rule?
That was, and that was freshwater fish, and that has been done for a long period of time. I guess what I'm referring to now is marine aquaculture. It's growing the kind of species that we used to have to go out, obviously, and fish and catch ourselves.
So we're caught in a bind right now. There's an increased demand for seafood at the same time that we have fished out any number of different kinds of fish. We've overfished.
That's right. In many ways, we have. I mean, you'll have scientists who differ on this, and fisheries scientists, they have very heated debates exactly on what's going on, but it's very hard to avoid the fact that, especially when it comes to the most prized, the big predators, say tunas, marlins, fish like that, they are disappearing very quickly. They're being taken much faster than they're being replaced, and it's very hard, even if you can keep that 90 million tons, and even that's questionable because there are a lot of studies that indicate that that's only been able to be sustained because we keep finding new areas. Obviously, at some point, the oceans, as vast as they are not infinite.
So how do we explain this increased interest in eating fish?
Well, I think there's a health factor that's very, very key. I mean, you actually saw the USDA in its most recent dietary guidelines up the recommended seafood diet for Americans, now 8 ounces per week for everyone.
Twice what we eat now.
Which is exactly twice what we eat now. We think, that Americans are emptying the oceans. In fact, most of us eat very little seafood. I mean, that's, 4 ounces or so of seafood is about half, it's like one tuna sandwich, perhaps.
So in other countries, like Japan, it's a much higher percentage, isn't it?
Japan, I believe, eats about 130, the average Japanese person eats about 130 pounds of fish a year.
Well, so we have this recommended food guideline. Does that mean that we can expect to see a fish consumption go up?
Well, I think
A lot of Americans just don't like fish.
Yeah, I mean, that's entirely possible. I mean, a lot of Americans, I think, don't like fish. But you're seeing it, you're seeing things like sushi penetrate, what was once a strange delicacy for a very maybe urban consumption. Now you see it much more spread out across the country. And I think that cardiovascular message, the message of omega-3s that are so important for heart health, is getting out there as well.
Well, does that apply to farm fish? Aren't they lower in omega-3s?
It actually when it comes to omega-3s, it depends on the fish. I mean, with salmon, tend to be higher on omega-3s, but it's true that there have been some studies that indicate that because of the diet they're fed, farmed salmon might have less. Of course, it depends on how you compare them. Are you comparing them to land animals? Then you're still obviously looking at a much healthier meal for the most part than beef or chicken.
But they're also not swimming across the ocean, so they're not developing all sorts of things, muscles. I would think that the omega-3s as well would be a result of just that exercise.
Well, the omega-3s are also a result of the kind of diet they're getting. Wild fish, salmon are carnivores, just like tunas. They eat other fish. And so they're getting fish oils, and that's how they develop those omega-3s. Farm fish, and this really depends on which kind of production you're talking about. There's a variety out there. But they do get fed much more in the way of plants, soy, even corn, and that sort of lowers those levels.
How much of a factor is price? Is wild-caught fish a lot more expensive than farm fish?
It's becoming that way. And in some ways, that's actually a good thing. If you actually go and try to get wild Alaskan salmon, That fishery actually is managed very well, and they've been very successful in recent years in essentially branding it in that way, that there is a difference between a farm fish. I'm not arguing, and a wild one, I'm not arguing that they're equal. It's more of a sense that we actually should be paying more for that kind of wild fish. That's a valuable resource from the ocean that is limited. Whereas farm fish, we're talking more about how do we spread as wide as possible this benefit protein, not just here in the United States, but really thinking for the developing world, really thinking for that new rising middle class around the world, of people who are just now seeing that they can expand their diets.
So the higher prices actually keep consumption down and means that we don't overfish them?
Well, I think
I would think that a fisherman thinking, gee, I'm going to get more for this wild salmon, he'd want to catch even more than he did in the past.
Right. Well, that's why it's important for wild fisheries to be managed correctly. And something like Alaska is something where we've been much more successful than, say, in the East. In New England, we have the legacy of overfishing. We have fishermen who no longer have jobs, actually who are transiting into fish farming in part because there aren't the catcheries are not open the way they used to be. But there has been success in Alaska, other sustainably managed fisheries, where you can kind of basically set a limit, say this is what's viable from the ocean, this is what you can take.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has just announced today, in fact, a new federal policy that will open up large swaths of coastal waters. Is that because of concerns about imported farm fish?
I think it's
and the pressure of fishermen on the East Coast?
It's a recognition that we do need to sort of begin to grow our own industry. It's actually quite amazing. 84% of the seafood that's eaten in America is imported. And when it comes to aquaculture, about half of our U.S. fish is farmed. Only 5% of our aquaculture fish comes from American fish farms. And that's for a lot of reasons. I mean, one big one is that it's very hard. Permitting is not easy. There's been very little emphasis on it from a federal level. Hopefully that may be changing with what NOAA is doing. But also there's a lot of, you know, there's pushback often in coastal areas, people who don't necessarily want to see fish farms, who assume that they must be dirty.
On the other hand, the fishermen are caught in this bind. They know that the more they fish, the less they're going to have in the future. At the same time, they're losing jobs, and the government has issued all sorts of guidelines. These new guidelines look like they're going to be any fairer?
I think they will hopefully begin to get a bit fair. I mean, you've had such debates in the past over this. I mean, you imagine you're a fisherman, you're faced with trying to make your living on a day-to-day basis. You know, you can't necessarily worry about what's going to happen to your fishery in a year's time, 5 years' time, 10 years' time. For the government, we're looking at ways to try to figure out what is scientifically actually viable. What can, you know, it's almost if you think about it as a bank account. If you take into the principal, you may be getting more, but you're going to lose it eventually. You have to think of it as something that delivers an interest, and a sustainably managed wild fishery can, but that is limited.
My guest is Brian Walsh, a senior writer for Time magazine. His article, The End of the Line, is the cover story of the July 18th issue of the magazine. What are some of the concerns that fish farming raises? Is it its environmental impact, health concerns, the quality of the fish?
It's in many ways, it's all of the above. The environmental concerns, and let's focus on, again, on marine aquaculture, and that's raising like salmon and those kind of fish. Especially when it was first being done in the 70s, you had concern over the sheer amount of waste that's being produced. You can imagine pack 20,000 or so salmon into a concentrated area in coastal waters. There's a lot of waste, just as you would see on land.
And what happens to that waste? Does it just filter out into the ocean?
It filters out into the ocean, but it can cause problems with the oxygen levels in the water. It can foul water. It's certainly not pleasant necessarily to be nearby. So that's a clear problem. Another issue is the risk that farmed species could actually escape and get into the wild. Again, to take the salmon example. You're raising a farm salmon, just like a farmed pig. It's very different than a wild boar. Same thing with a farmed salmon. It gets out. It may mix with the wild salmon, may spread diseases that are more common in a close, confined environment that are not common in the wild. We've seen that with something called sea lice. Those are the sort of worries you have, and it can actually damage the wild population.
But aren't they also vaccinating these farm fish?
They are. I mean, that's what they're trying. That's a key part of health.
I'm not so sure I like that either.
Really? Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think.
I mean, we've done something like that with cattle, and
right.
We've seen negative consequences.
We have. I mean, this is where we get to
the antibiotic, you know, resistance to antibiotics,
right.
For example.
Yeah, I mean, that's why there are better ways to try to do this. I mean, one point that we make in the story is something called integrated multitrophic aquaculture, which is a very long title that basically means trying to create something that actually mimics a natural ecosystem.
But you actually visited a fish farm in Massachusetts, but you write that it looked more like a factory than a farm.
Right. Well, that's a different sort. I mean, I pointed out the problems that you have with farmed fish out when you're talking about the wild ocean. What they're doing in Australis Aquaculture, that's the name of the company that I visited in Massachusetts, they actually do it indoors. And so they actually circulate all the water. They recycle and filter that water and actually are able to recycle almost all the waste. It actually goes on and becomes manure on a farmed field. So that's a sort of contained system that, for an environmentalist perspective, is about as perfect as you can get.
What do these fish eat?
These fish, and these are barramundi, and that's sort of an interesting fish that comes from Australia and Southeast Asia that you may not know that well, but very popular down there. And they eat about 20% or so is fish meal, and that's going to be usually like low forage fish on the marine food chain. The rest is a mix of soy mostly. And I hadn't pointed out before, I mean, what you feed the fish is very important, because another concern we have about farmed fish is that, again, if you're talking about carnivores, they need to eat wild fish. And there's a concern like you may be farming a salmon, but in doing so, you may be actually taking away a lot of the bottom of the food chain. So that's why you look for species like, say, this barramundi that don't need that much fish meal and actually can produce more fish protein than they're taking in when it comes to fish meal.
Well, I can't remember ever seeing barramundi on any restaurant menu.
Well,
so are they giving it another name?
No, it's funny. I mean, they've trademarked the name sustainable sea bass.
Sea bass.
Yeah, well, sea bass being something you can basically name any kind of fish. You probably heard of the Chilean sea bass. You may not know its real name, the Patagonian toothfish. It was rebranded and probably one of the all-time great examples of improving a product's name. The barramundi, only about 50,000 tons are actually farmed around the world, but it is growing. If you go to restaurants that are focused on sustainable seafood. Actually, if you go to Fresh Direct, you can get it there as well. And that's something that, not only being sustainable, but also has fairly high levels of omega-3s. And so, you know, it's a fairly healthy fish, and it's also pretty good as well.
Farm fish can be very different from their wild counterparts. We've been talking about salmon. Mm-hmm. Don't they have to dye farm-raised salmon to make them look like the other kind, to give their flesh a pink color?
That's true. I mean, that is one of the common issues that they have with it, is that it would be a kind of grayish color if you didn't add that pink dye.
What about, I mentioned earlier that they don't swim long distances, so they don't have muscular development. Would that give it a different taste?
I don't know. I mean, I've had Alaskan wild salmon. I'll take that as an example, because you can't, you know, when you're talking about farm salmon, that's Atlantic salmon, of which there is almost none left in the wild. It's almost all comes from farm now. So if you're getting wild salmon, it's most likely going to be from the Pacific. It does taste better.
Couldn't we release some farm salmon into the ocean, some that we know are healthy, and replenish stocks?
You could do that, except I don't think they would do very well in the wild. I mean, what would happen if you released 1,000 dairy cows into the wild? I don't think they'd be able to handle it. You have to think of them in the same kind of way. These are animals that have been bred to live in these kind of conditions.
They would wind up adjusting. I've seen it happening. In fact, there is a dairy farmer that I know who has been allowing his dairy cattle mm-hmm. to breed back to the Neolithic style, and suddenly they are brown with long hair. They prefer to congregate in glens. Mm-hmm. Just as they would have in the past. They kind of disappear now because their coloring is similar to the woods. So if we don't mess with them, if we don't force them to go in certain directions, they wind up going back to their natural state.
I guess that's possible. I mean, you know, it's funny because that is, at the same time, that's exactly what most environmentalists don't want to have happen with farm salmon. They worry very much about them getting out, you know, damaging the gene pool of those wild fish.
But we put wolves back into the wild.
Well, we don't domesticate wolves, though.
My guest is Brian Walsh, a senior writer for Time magazine. His article, The End of the Line, appears in the July 18th issue, the current issue of the magazine. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Brian Walsh, a senior writer for Time magazine. His article, The End of the Line, appears in the July 18th issue, the current issue of the magazine. It's the cover story, although the cover has a different title, The Future of Fish, Can Farming Save the Last Wild Food? Why is it so hard to raise certain types of fish like cod than others?
Well, it's cod is one example. Another great example is something like bluefin tuna, that very popular sushi delicacy. And part of the reason why is that they require so much feed to get in. I mean, they actually require so much food to produce 1 pound of fish that economically it's not really worth it.
Although we do the same sort of thing with beef cattle, don't we?
That's true. In that case, you're looking at corn as opposed to a wild. You need to actually get wild forage fish in the case for these. But that's sort of, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because that underscores one of the advantages that aquaculture has. You know, we're talking about comparing it to wild fisheries, but if you compare it to other forms of protein, if you compare it to raising beef, if you compare it to raising chickens or pigs, aquaculture is actually a lot more efficient on a sort of pound-by-pound basis, mostly because fish are cold-blooded, so they don't need to generate energy to keep themselves warm like land animals do. And they're floating in the water, so they don't need heavy skeletons. So more of the feed goes to the kind of things we actually want to eat.
But the ones that are highest on the food chain are the ones that are hardest to raise. Does that mean that they're more likely to be exposed to the toxins through the fish that are lower on the food chain?
Well, that's – if you're talking about – yeah, I mean, that's absolutely something that does happen with wild fish, that you have these fish are the ones that collect
mercury.
All those all the way up. Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, one concern we have actually with wild tuna, of course, is mercury levels that come in many ways from burning coal that gets in the air, gets into the water, then works its way up there from the tuna and then, of course, to us because we're at the top of the food chain.
There are concerns about imported farm fish. They don't have the same standards that we apply in this country, and yet you say that we only eat 5% of mm-hmm. our own domestically raised farm fish. So how do we avoid problems? Haven't there been cases of fish that were imported to the United States that contained chemicals that are banned here?
That is true. I mean, this is one of the big concerns you have is that, for instance, China by far is the number one fish farmer in the world. About 61% of the world's farm fish actually comes from China. Most of it stays in China, but they do export more and more fish like tilapia, shrimp. You get that from Southeast Asia. And it is a very big concern that you're not seeing the same standards carried out there that you have with aquaculture here in the U.S., say you're in Canada or in Norway. And there isn't really anywhere near enough oversight on that kind of imported seafood. It's far too easy, whether it's seafood or actually other food as well, for tainted food to get through and to get into the American supply.
China accounts for 62% of fish farming worldwide, but a lot of that is eaten domestically, isn't it? The Chinese eat a lot of fish.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is mostly eaten domestically. In fact, the big fish there is carp, which is something I think very few Americans would want to eat. Actually, it's very bony. It's hard to eat, but it's very popular there. But they are growing. You are seeing fish farming for export growing as well. And you're also seeing a bigger range of diet in China. You're seeing people wanting to go beyond the kind of the seafood they've eaten for a long time, discovering something like salmon, discovering something like sushi. And you can imagine once you get hundreds of millions of people in China with the income now to eat in that way, that really is far more of a defining factor than anything happening here in the U.S.
As I understand it, China is actually better in controlling the quality of the farm fish than some other countries.
They can be better. I mean, they've stepped it up in recent years. They had, I think a lot of it was coming out of concerns about the export market. They sort of recognized that if they didn't improve food for these sort of standards, they would lose that.
What about farm fish from Thailand, for example?
Right. Thailand, one of the big concerns there, and you're talking about shrimp when you're coming out of Thailand, is actually the environmental damage that's been done by the creation for these farms. You have to clear land, or it's actually clear coastal water, sort of. And you have these things called mangrove forests, which are essentially underwater forests, which are brilliant habitats for species, for fish. They're actually also great protections against things like tsunamis and storms as well. They get cleared out to make room for those shrimp, and you have a lot of knock-on damage done to that marine environment, which actually, again, is not too dissimilar to what happens with agriculture. We clear forests to create land for raising food. Now we're worrying about doing the same thing for the seas.
A listener wonders where the fish in Chinatown markets come from.
I guess it would depend on which kind of fish you're talking about. I know that you can get fish there that you can't really get anywhere else. If it's coming from carp, there actually are domestic – I know there are domestic carp producers. In fact, you may have heard of the carp invasion in the Great Lakes. This fish is supposed to be going to eat up the entire ecosystem there. Well, that originally came out of carp farms from the Midwest. They were hit by floods 20, 30 years ago. They spilled into the Mississippi River, and they've been kind of making their way up there since. So there are fish you can get domestically as well.
Obviously, since much of the stuff you can get in Chinatown is less expensive than elsewhere, it's less likely to be imported because that does raise the price. What we've been seeing in Chinese foods is an awful lot of production in this country as Chinese food has become more popular.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you'll get a lot of it domestically. You might get it. It's funny. I mean, you'd think that the cost of imports would really raise it, would make it prohibitive. But that's really surprisingly not the case.
Charlie in Atlantic Highlands in New Jersey asked, where does tilapia come from? He says, I never heard of it until a few years ago. I don't think any of us heard of it until a few years ago.
I know. Tilapia is one of the amazing stories of the globalization of a certain kind of food. It's the Nile perch. It was originally from there. It's a vegetarian fish, so it doesn't eat other fish the way that most marine species do.
So it lends itself to fish farming.
Exactly. I mean, it's sustainable in that sense. You can feed it just about anything. You can feed it corn, you can feed it soy, and it'll grow. It handles very dense environments fairly well, much more so than marine species. And so it comes all over the place. I mean, it's made in China. It's made a lot of it's in Latin America now. There are a lot of farms there as well. And while it is more sustainable from a diet perspective, it's not as healthy as most marine species. It doesn't have very high levels of omega-3s. And, you know, you talk to chefs, they don't really like it very much because it tends to be kind of tasteless.
Mm. They have to put all sorts of stuff in it to actually give it any kind of flavor.
Exactly.
The shellfish industry accounts for 2/3 of the American aquaculture industry. Is it relatively easy to raise shellfish in a farm setting, or does that present its own set of challenges?
It's easier because, especially if you're talking about mollusks, if you're talking about oysters, you're talking about mussels, they're very low in the food chain. They're actually filter feeders, you know, which means they actually can take some pollutants out of the water. And so you see in areas like Maine, there's a very vibrant shellfish industry there. And I had mentioned before about that sort of integrated aquaculture system. Mollusks and mussels are actually a very key part of that because they sort of can take some of the pollution that may be there from raising a finfish like a salmon, filter it out, and so you end up actually getting a natural form of pollution filter, plus you get, you know, mussels.
In the case of putting all these fish together, I'm not thinking about mussels, is there evidence that raising them in this farm setting, which is really close, puts any stress on them?
I think it does put some stress on them. It definitely does. And that's one concern going forward, is that if you expand this in a way that basically what I would be worried about, aquaculture is very young, is to see it go down the same route that industrial agriculture has on land, where there's just an emphasis on packing as many species together as closely as possible, not worrying about pollution, kind of offloading that. Aquaculture, especially in North America, especially in the United States, is still very young. It's still a very small industry. This is the time where you can put the kind of right guidelines. And in some ways, what NOAA is doing, hopefully, we'll be able to do that. You want to create the situation where the United States is leading the world when it comes to the right way to do aqua farming, not kind of racing to the bottom with other countries.
My guest is Brian Walsh, senior writer for Time magazine. His article, The End of the Line, appears in the July 18th issue of the magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what you just said, in effect, is that the fact that this is an emerging industry allows for a chance to get things right.
Very much so, I think. You know, I mean, it is hard to sort of take this into account, the fact that aquaculture is so young, agriculture is so – it's been there for such a long time. The agricultural lobby, as I'm sure you're familiar with in the United States, is extremely powerful. Very hard to get anything changed there. Very hard to get new laws put in place. Very hard to fight these people. Aquaculture is tiny. They have no lobby whatsoever. And I think this is the point where, you know, this is an industry that needs to develop from a sort of global perspective for when it comes to eating protein, when it comes to meeting that expected doubling in food demand that the UN expects by mid-century. We're going to need this kind of industry. And now, if you put these steps in now, you can make sure we don't see the same problems we've seen with agriculture.
You write about efforts to recreate a natural ecosystem as a way of minimizing the impact of farm-raised fish. What goes into creating that kind of system?
Well, it creates a system that you have, say, take a commercial species like a salmon, a finfish. They're sort of in an open net, much like you would see in a conventional farm. You feed them feed. They produce waste. Some of the feed gets down. You also have bottom feeders. You might have lobsters, for instance. They can sort of take up some of the leftover feed, make sure that doesn't build up the way it might in a commercial farm. Then you also have shellfish. You have you have mussels, for instance, oysters. They're filter feeders. They can actually filter out the waste that comes from those commercial fish and create a system where you have cleaner water. You have a variety of species you can raise. And, you know, you have a system that's much better off. I mean, the challenge is that from a commercial perspective, that's tougher for a producer because it's much easier for them to focus on one species than try to keep three and find a market for all of them.
And put them in a big tank and control them that way. So these kinds of farms, which sound really reasonable, aren't all that common?
No, this is a new experiment. I mean, it's actually one of the leaders here is a guy named Thierry Chopin at the University of New Brunswick in Canada. He's been experimenting with this for a while. And there is actually at least one Canadian aquaculture company called Cook Aquaculture that's begun doing this commercially. You know, it's something that will take work because it puts more stress on producers. They have to learn how to do this. But, I mean, it makes perfect sense. Actually, we could do this on land as well. Before industrial agriculture, we had systems that were mixed. You had crops. You had different kinds of animals as well, and that created a better system.
And we've been hearing about the idea of building farms in buildings where you have the cows at the top, and then their manure gets used to grow crops, and everything gets moved down floor by floor by floor. But I haven't seen any of those places built.
No. I mean, that's the problem is that, you know, it sounds great in theory. It's harder to get someone to do that commercially. But if you create the kind of regulations that say, make it very difficult to just let that waste go and not pay for it, maybe that changes the economics of it.
Well, with the current Congress, I don't think that's likely. Mary asks, what happened to flounder? When I was a kid, she said, we had it all the time. Now I rarely see it in the markets. Have they been overfished?
I believe they have been overfished. And I think also, you know, you did used to see a greater, you know, more local, similar to the way you see with other foods. It was common that you had fish from around nearby where you were. I mean, you wouldn't be shipping it across the country or shipping it certainly across the world. That's one change. And that's something I think is also kind of limited our tastes. Americans, really, we like our shrimp. We like our salmon. We like our tuna. We don't have a lot of other varieties here. But I think in the past, especially if you live near the ocean or you live near areas with a variety of marine species, you grew up with a much more varied marine diet than I think Americans have now.
You write about how fish is the last of the wild foods, or was the last of the wild foods, a kind of last frontier. Have we crossed the threshold now when it comes to food production?
Well, I think, you know, we are crossing that 50% threshold where, you know, 50% of that seafood is going to be coming from farms. So I think that shows that we're on a sort of scale where wild fishing is not going away by any means.
But it'll go the way of wild strawberries.
It'll become more rare. Yeah, that's entirely possible in the sense it becomes more rare, it becomes more valuable in a sense too, which is probably for the best in some ways.
On the other hand, another factor that we tend to overlook is that fishing is one of the most dangerous jobs in the United States. And as terrible as these fish farms may appear to some of us, they're going to save lives.
That's entirely possible. You're right. I mean, fishing is more dangerous than mining. It's more dangerous than being a cop or security guard. I mean, it's a dangerous job out there. I mean, there's so many ways that things can go wrong. There's so many ways that even from an economic perspective, I mean, you can go out there and not find it, literally.
Do the old-time fishermen see this as serious competition?
They have in the past seen this competition. I mean, we talked about Alaskan salmon, and there was a lot of concern. In fact, it did a lot of damage to the farmed salmon from Chile because they were able to sort of have very few in the way of regulations. They could produce very cheap salmon. They flooded the market. The Alaskan salmon were kind of wiped out in that way. So they used to see it in that sense. I think now you're seeing more fishermen, especially on the East Coast, I know, going from wild fishing into aquaculture. And for them, this is a way to keep working on the water. You know, I mean, if wild fishing is not going to do it, then becoming a steward of the sea, in a sense, very different kind of job, but still something that gets them out there on a boat in the water, which is what they love.
Why aren't we seeing more fish farms in the United States? Are the regulations just too restrictive here?
The regulations are somewhat restrictive. It's very, you know, it varies a lot from state to state. And one huge issue is that our coasts are very valuable. The coast of Massachusetts, the coast of Maine, these are coasts especially that people will spend a lot of money to have summer homes. And people who spend a lot of money to have a summer home in Maine are not real keen on the idea of having, say, a salmon farm outside their house, even though this is a waterfront that has been worked in various ways for decades. That's a powerful influence to try to overcome.
They don't want windmills out there either.
They don't want windmills either.
Brian Walsh is a senior writer for Time magazine. His article, The End of the Line, appears in the current issue, the July 18th issue. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.